Good evening, this is Dr. Dan J. Guerra, this Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 18 February, 2024. We're going to be doing lecture number 9 in Mosaic 1, which is drilling down to phosphatidic acid, phosphatase, as a component of a regulation of mitochondrial fission, fusion, and then associated cellular fate. That's why it's a mosaic, because we're including multiple layers of biochemical trajectories, including pathways, and cellular and subcellular functions. Okay. So, start off with a little bit of epistemology. I say the truth is the essential purpose of human reason. But it seems to often instill fear. I think it does so because it captures the potential weakness of some people's heart. And that weakness is then revealed to his soul. So authenticity, including authenticity in science or biochemistry specifically, is a means by which truth may be obtained and maintained. So, mitochondrial fission is a multi-step process. Of course, it follows a division of one mitochondrion into two daughter mitochondria. It's regulated by the GTPase dynamin-related protein 1, that's GRP1. It does so by adaptation to the actin and the ER-mediated mitochondrial constriction sites, both of which are proteinaceous. So the GRP1 oligomerization is followed by this mitochondrial constriction, and it leads to the recruitment of a second dynamin protein called dynamin 2, and that terminates membrane scission. So the inner mitochondrial membrane constriction is an independent process, and it's actually regulated by the influx of calcium ions. Whereas mitochondrial fusion is a two-step process with the outer mitochondrial membrane fusion, mediated by those two mitofusins, 1 and 2, followed immediately with the inner membrane fusion, which of course you know is mediated by the protein called optic atrophy 1 or OPA 1. Now, in addition to the roles of those polypeptides, membrane lipid composition, and by that I mean sequence of lipids, must be an appropriate mole percent in order for the protein machinery to function. And this starts from the insertion of those proteins into the membrane, which of course is a post-translational event, as well as the functioning of those polypeptides once the triggering mechanism is initiated for either fission or fusion. Okay. So that's a summary where we're at. More than a summary, it's getting deeply into it. Now, some of the players, of course, phosphatidylserine decarboxylase. That enzyme promotes mitochondrial fusion. It does so by regulating some of the biophysical properties of the mitochondrial membrane, where it generates an alternative topogenesis of the mitochondrial genome maintenance protein 1. So the decarboxylase, which of course is going to generate phosphatidylethanolamine, a key player in the phosphatidic acid phosphatase de novo synthesis pathway, hence why we're doing the mosaic around the phosphatase and not around this PS decarboxylase. Furthermore, what this tells us is the membrane lipid component involves the regulation of a protein which maintains the mitochondrial genome's fidelity. Hence, you see it's carrying out multiple functions, including the fidelity of the mitochondrial genome. Okay? So it's yet another very important concept. Now, more on membrane phosphoethylamine. PE regulates mitochondrial fusion. Decreasing PE, phosphoethylamine, reduces the rate of lipid mixing. It also reduces the expression of MGM1, the mitochondrial fusion protein. So we can conclude at least at one level from that, because this phosphatidylserine decarboxylase is involved in phosphatidylethanolamine biosynthesis. We could argue that that enzyme regulates lipid and protein machinery in the process of mitochondrial fusion. But we're going to find out that the phosphatidylserine decarboxylase is downstream from the phosphatidic acid, phosphatase, at least indirectly and perhaps directly. We'll see all that when I explain all the phospholipid pathways. So obviously, we have to understand how lipid metabolism is regulating the mitochondrial dynamics, because ultimately, that's going to regulate cell fate. For example, a distinction between apoptosis and autophagy. So I want you to keep in mind that non-bilayer forming lipids, one of them very significant in the mitochondria, cardiolipin, a second very important in the mitochondria, phosphatidic acid, and indeed the third one we've been talking about, center stage, phosphatidylethanolamine, those are all non-bilayer forming lipids. They generate negative membrane curvature, and that physical function promotes membrane fusion. Okay. So if you look at the mitochondrially localized phosphatidylserine decarboxylase isoform 1, which is directly responsible for the synthesis of phosphatidylethanolamine, we see that that system is essential for proper mitochondrial morphology and fusion in the yeast system. So a paper published way back in 2012 in Journal of Biological Chemistry, I'll put in the show notes, of course, is talking all about yeast fusion kinetics. And when I was going through the phospholipid metabolic pathway with you, talking about the nucleotide pathway and the de novo pathway directly starting from ethanolamine or from serine to ethanolamine, not being phosphorylated and not being a component of phospholipid, I want you to understand that the nucleotide pathway and the decarboxylate pathway are not both represented in both yeast and mammalian tissues. There are some components of each of those pathways dispersed in those two different eukaryotes. Now that's interesting, because mitochondrial molecular genetics and lipid biochemistry tend to be pretty heavily preserved in all eukaryotes. Yet what I just said to you, and we'll tear it apart here, the processes which mitochondria are involved in, including fission, fusion, mitophagy, and associated cellular fate, are not necessarily regulated via the phospholipid pathways that we find canonical in both lower eukaryotes and in mammals, because there's a differential of the expression of those genes, as it turns out, and also an alteration of the expression of the protein products after translation, whether or not those proteins are found in the endoplasmic reticulum, the mitochondrial inner membrane, or elsewhere in the cell distributed. Okay? So that's where there's a distinction. We have to be able to separate these out because we want to be authentic in our discussion. So yeah, these two non-bilayer forming mitochondrial phospholipids that we've been talking a bit about. Phosphatidic acid is not usually described because it's very low mole percent. But the very significant ones in the mitochondria are cardiolipin, which is diphosphatidylglycerol, and of course, PE, phosphatidylethylamine. Okay? And those two lipids, because they're non-bilayer forming, seem to have overlapping roles. And in fact, if neither of those membrane lipids are found, the mitochondria is totally dysfunctional. So at least one of those non-bilayer forming mitochondrial phosphoglycerol lipids are necessary for mitochondrial function. Okay, so that's an interesting thing. Now, this has been studied. This paper we're going to just blow right past. It's well studied in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And so I'm not going to go through that entire paper. I just wanted to extract from it the roles of these different phospholipids, negative curvature and fusion, in the model system yeast that was being studied some 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Because yeast membrane fusion and fission is not recalcitrant to study because it's basically a microorganism. So it's easy to study in culture. Mammalian cells, because they differentiate in culture, adds another level of complexity, as well as how the mitochondria turn over in mammalian cells in culture, which they notoriously do. Okay, for reasons associated with hypoxia and bioenergetics. Okay. Now, mitochondrial membrane biogenesis and lipid metabolism both require phosphoglycerol lipid transfer from the ER to the mitochondria. And that transfer is in regions where the two organelles are in direct contact. So it's non-vesicular trafficking. So when you study this, what you find is that you have an ER membrane protein complex that, when it is decreased in phosphatidylserine transfer from the ER to the mitochondria, there is a dysregulation of mitochondrial biology. Okay. Now, the reason that is, phosphatidylserine is a direct precursor to phosphatidylethanolamine, but phosphatidylethanolamine can also be the substrate for phosphatidylserine biosynthesis. Okay? So you have all of this complex interaction between the ER and the mitochondria linking PS and PE transfer between those two membranes in association with mitochondrial integrity. Remember, the mitochondria we're emphasizing here in this mosaic for multiple reasons. One is because the mitochondria has a genome to protect, and that genome is absolutely necessary for the eukaryotic system to function. Remember, you have two genomes in animal eukaryotic systems. You have three genomes in plant systems, higher plants. Chloroplast genome, mitochondrial genome, nuclear genome in plants. In animals, it's simpler. You only have the mitochondrial and the nuclear, okay? But we have to discuss how the endoplasmic reticulum plays a role in mitochondrial membrane regulation, no matter where we are in our discussions, because the ER plays a role. And I mentioned that to you two lectures ago when I talked to you about phosphoglycerol lipid biosynthesis requiring both the ER membrane and the mitochondrial membrane. Go back and listen to that if you don't recall. And I'm going to bring it up again, don't worry. Now, phosphatidylethanolamine pathways are described at the ER mitochondrial interface. So you have a base exchange pathway, and there the biosynthesis of phosphatidylserine head group, that is the phosphoserine, can exchange with phosphoethanolamine. and that's mediated by a specific enzyme called PSS2. And that PSS2 is found in mammals. Okay, so here we're talking about movement of the entire head group. We're not talking about decarboxylation from PS to PE here. So the reverse can occur also. So you can go from PE to PS and PS to PE without any decarboxylase or nucleotide biosynthesis, nucleotide-associated biosynthesis of those head groups. Remember through the CDP diacylglycerol. Call from those from the lectures. Don't worry, we'll go back to it again. So phosphoethanolamine is generated by the phosphorylation of ethanolamine by an enzyme called ethanolamine kinase, but it can also be synthesized through the degradation of sphingolipids by the DP11P. So here, phosphoethanolamine and CTP can be ultimately metabolized by CTP, phosphonoethanolamine, cytidyl transferase. That will generate CDP ethanolamine, which, in association with diacylglycerol, ethanolamine phosphotransferase, will allow for the condensation reaction with DAG to form PE. Phosphatidylserine decarboxylase pathway is distinct. PS is transported from the mitochondrial membrane space between the two membranes to the ER through the outer membrane. This phosphatidylserine can also be retrotransported to the inner mitochondrial membrane. And that's where this enzyme, PSD1P, is located. So you have sphingolipid metabolism, you have nucleotide metabolism, and you have straightforward decarboxylase activity. Two of those three are directly linked to phosphatidic acid phosphatase because of the generation of diacylglycerol. The only one that's not is the sphingolipid pathway, you see? Because diacylglycerol is the backbone of glycerol phospholipids, not sphingolipids. Sphingolipids, of course, can also be phospholipids, of course. All right? So keep that in mind. In mammalian cells, now, this is not absolutely strict, but it largely defines the system. In mammalian cells, phosphatidylserine is synthesized by a calcium-dependent reaction in which the head group of phosphatidylcholine or phosphatidylethanolamine is simply replaced by serine. And again, that reaction is catalyzed by PS synthase 1 or PSS1, which uses phosphatidylcholine, whereas PS synthase 2 uses phosphatidylethanolamine. Okay? Both of those mammals. Now, the mechanism for PS synthesis differs from that of yeast and bacteria, where the PS synthases that utilize CDP diacylglycerol as serine and other polar head group substrates. Okay? So that's what the distinction is. Yeast and bacteria are unique from mammals in that regard. Mammals have these novel head group synthases, and they also have a backdoor to the nucleotide pathway, starting directly from CDP-DAG. Okay? So PSS1 deficient mammalian cells can be isolated via phosphatidylserine auxotrophy. So you get cell growth that's dependent now, or auxotrophy, It's dependent on the presence of exogenous PSPE or simply ethanolamine. Now, this can be done with mammalian cells in culture and, of course, with microbes like yeast, right? And what's discovered then is these synthases, these phosphatidyl serine synthases 1 and 2, which utilize either PS or PE as their co-substrate, will both function as long as there is a ready source of that polar head group, either directly from the other phospholipid or from de novo synthesis, that is, from phosphonoethanolamine or phosphonoserine or phosphonocholine, see, not associated with the diacylglycerol. So that's the subtle distinction there. So with that as a prolegomena, let's go back to this 2019 Nature paper. mTORC1, remember that's a kinase that is anabolic in nature. It's involved in nation transcription translation in a highly energetic cell system, a dynamic cell system where there's no hypoxia. AMP kinase would be the antithesis of that, or at least the contrary to that. So mTORC1 kinase regulates mitochondrial function, and it does so via transcription and translation, those major activities. So, now get ready for this. Heterodoxically, stimulation of the YME1L-mediated proteolysis upon inhibition of mTORC1 occurs post-translationally. So mTORC's function as a translational mechanism of control is now obviated, you see? So as mTORC1 typically promotes lipid biosynthesis to support membrane biogenesis, alterations in the lipid composition of mitochondrial membranes resulting from the inhibition of mTORC1 obtains increased proteolysis by an in situ membrane anchored YME1L. Okay. Mitochondrial membranes that can be isolated from mTORC inhibited via TORIN1 treated wild type and YME1L double knockout cells will have less phosphatidylethanolamine than from untreated cells. So what does that mean relative to the protease? Well, let me continue on with the following evidence. The levels of phospholipids in general, and uniquely the acyl chain composition of phosphatidylethanolamine, doesn't change under those conditions. What conditions? mTORC inhibition. Okay. Now that suggests there was no de novo synthesis of PE. As far as the other glycerol lipids were concerned, their molecular species may or may not have obtained via what I call de novo substitution reactions. Phospholipase activity, for example, right? And then acylation back to the 1 or 2 position from acyl-CoA pools, okay? And I say may or may not because this particular 2019 paper only looked at PE molecular species, not the other phospholipids. Okay, so we don't know. I looked to see what happens in other papers that were published around that time when people were doing this kind of work in mammalian systems and subsequent to that. And I wasn't able to get a paper that showed me good molecular species, particularly of cardiolipin. So I'm not finished with that research, but I couldn't find anything for today's lecture. Okay, so mitochondrial PE levels were decreased, remember, in hypoxic cells. Remember that? Because of HIF-1 alpha. But also in cells, this is all review, starved for glutamine. Okay? That suggested that HIF-1 alpha and indeed tricarboxylic acid pathway anaplerosis were, if not necessary, were at least playing a role in mitochondrial membrane lipid turnover. Okay? Now, what occurred to this protease substrates in cells depleted of Prelid-3B, and Prelid-3B, you'll recall, is a lipid transfer protein that occurs in the intermembrane space that shuttles, this should now be reminiscent of what I mentioned to you 5 minutes ago, phosphatidylserine to the inner membrane for conversion to phosphatidylethanolamine via the constitutive intermembrane decarboxylase. Phosphatidylserine decarboxylase. Okay. So that gene encodes the phosphatidylserine decarboxylase, this mitochondrial localized enzyme that simply converts PS to PE specifically in the inner mitochondrial membrane. So they depleted this Prelid-3B, which inhibits the mobility of phosphatidylserine to the inner membrane. And now we know that. We know that the substrate for the decarboxylase isn't there. So what will happen? What will be the subsequent result of that experiment? Well, when you knock out or knock down Prelid-3B, of course, you get reduced mitochondrial phosphatidylethanolamine. But you also get a decreased level. This is how you're circumventing the mTORC here. Listen to how this works. You get a decreased level of the protease substrates. Okay. What does that suggest? That when phosphatidylethanolamine declines, you increase proteolysis. Means that phosphatidylethanolamine in the inner membrane regulates the suppression of the YME1L protease. And when phosphatidylethanolamine becomes deficient, the protease becomes active. And that has nothing to do with any nascent transcription translation. That's why mTORC has no role here. See? HIF-1 alpha also is not going to be a direct player here. This is all dealing with proteins in situ in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Okay? So confirming all of that, the expression of Prelid-3B, adding it back, but not the expression of an inactive mutant. So they had a mutant Prelid-3B where you went from T57 to a K. Okay? Restored the levels of both PE and those protease substrates. Okay, so that transfer protein's necessary for phosphatidylserine to make it in the mitochondria. That's what it says. Okay, and predictably, the depletion of the decarboxylase is going to reduce mitochondrial PE levels, and it's going to then allow for protease activity to enhance. Right, so the substrates of the protease are all going to be dropped. Now, what are the substrates of the protease? Remember what they were? There was the phospholipid transfer proteins and the polypeptide transfer proteins for the inner mitochondrial membrane. You see? So that protease will start decreasing the mobility of lipids and proteins to the inner mitochondrial membrane, which will make that inner mitochondrial membrane now dysfunctional for fusion. You see? All right. Now, conversely, there was a significant increase in mitochondrial PE levels in TSC2 double knockout cells. Now, remember when you have a TSC2,
which normally controls mTORC1, and you knock out TSC2, you get a hyperactive non